So far what we have done is looked at the first parak as a broad overview of the introduction to Sefer Shoftim. We've explored the issues related to the period of time, the whole introduction to the idea of having gone into the land of Israel, Yeshua's conquest of Israel, and the partial completion of the conquest, the mission which was originally to create an idolatry-free zone in Eretz Knaan from north to south in the entire region of the Shvatim, which would have required each Shevet to essentially clean out of their territory the idolatrous culture from its midst, whether that meant either by war with the local population or with the population accepting upon themselves the Sheva Mitzvot Bnei Noach, major debate amongst the... some did one and some did the other. But for the most part, and what we saw in the overview of the parak, for the most part, the tribes were partially successful in doing just that. They were primarily successful in the area of the mountains, less successful in the area of the plains, strategically because of the fact that they couldn't fight the Canaanites in the plains because of the chariots. And therefore, the parak gives us a list of which tribes were more or less successful in each area. That's essentially an overview of where we're at. Okay? The orange being the area where the Israelites were able to settle. The yellow on the map, for the most part, being the Canaanite regions. And that is the balance of power that will remain, give or take, the balance of power that will remain that way till Shmuel Hanavi. And therefore, when we start Sefer Shmuel, we will change maps.
When is it?
When we finish Shoftim.
I just wanted to know when.
For 3 years.
Give or take. All right. What I wanted to do at this point was to zero in, to focus on two specific issues in this parak, which we'll do over the next, with this week and next week, B'zat Hashem, and then we'll move on to Perek Bet. But now we've done the overview, sort of looked at this from the from a broad perspective, and I want to focus on two specific issues. The first is an issue which we actually addressed in Sefer Yehoshua. We're going to review it for the benefit of those who are here and learn it afresh for those who were not with us. But I want to look at the story of Shevet Shimon. Shevet Shimon is a fascinating story. And whereas the parak goes through tribe by tribe, who is able to conquer more, who is able to conquer less, the one tribe that kind of gets a focus, but a mysterious one, is Shimon. So let's go back to the beginning of the parak, and let's take a look at where we are at. Does everybody have a source page? Did everybody get the source pages we're floating around? And if you don't have a Tanakh today, I brought the Tanakhs here for the benefit of all, because we are going to jump around a little bit. Surprise, surprise. All right. The story begins right at the beginning of the Sefer, when they are...
The very beginning?
Very beginning. We're going back to the beginning of Perek Aleph. We are... Back to the beginning of Perek Aleph. Vahi acharei mot Yehoshua vayishalu b'nei Yisrael b'Hashem lemor mi ya'ale lanu el ha'Kanani b'tchila lehilachem bo. Review again of the events of the conquest of Canaan, which is essentially a recap of events that are taking place in Sefer Yehoshua. This entire parak is a recap of Sefer Yehoshua. Even though it starts after the death of Yeshua, those four words are really parenthetical. They're an introduction to the Sefer. Sefer Yeshua is Acharei Mot Yeshua. Now, Perek Aleph begins by recapping that which took place during the time of Yehoshua and the beginning of the conquest of each tribe into their territory, which, if you remember, is the second half of Yehoshua after Yehoshua's national conquest. Vayomer Hashem, Yehuda Ya'aleh, Yehuda will go first. The land is given into his hands. that Yehuda should be the first tribe to begin his sort of focus on his region is not surprising to anyone. We talked about this a little bit. Not surprising because why is it not surprising that Yehuda should go first? Why would we expect Yehuda to be the first? Not the first time, not the last time. Yehuda will always go first. Leadership. Right? Yehuda is the tribe of Malchus. Yehuda is the tribe that generally is the strongest, the largest of all the tribes. If you go back to Sefer Bereshit, and you go back to the Brachos of Yaakov, when he's going through his children, he starts with Reuven. Talk about leadership amongst the tribes. Reuven, Shimon, and Levi, each for various reasons, essentially write themselves out of the running for leadership of the Shvatim. Reuven, partially because of the story of Bilhah, partially for the story of Yosef. Shimon and Levi, certainly because of the events of Shechem. Each one of them essentially take themselves out of the running for the role of leadership of the tribes, leaving the field open for Yehuda from Leah, and of course Yosef from Rachel. And the two primary leadership firstborn tribes of the two wives of Yaakov, Yehuda and Yosef, therefore become essentially, historically, the two anchors of leadership in Israel. Many, many, many years later, when the Malchus will split into two, it will split between Yehuda in the south and all the other tribes to the north, but essentially led by
Ephraim.
Yeravim ben Nevat, who splits the kingdom from Shevet Ephraim, and the Nevi'im always refer to the northern kingdom as the kingdom of Ephraim. Ephraim ben Yosef. So the role of Yehuda and Yosef as the leadership amongst the people is something which, while solidified in Sefer Bereshit, carries through all of Jewish history. And then Yehuda does something which is going to catch our attention now. Vayomer Yehuda l'Shimon achiv, ale iti begorali v'nilachama b'knani, v'halachti gam ani itcha begoralecha. Shimon, you come and fight with me in my tribe, in my territory, and I will go and fight with you in your territory. Vayelech ito Shimon. And Shimon agrees. The next piece describes the area in which Yehuda fights for his tribal territory, the cities Yerushalayim, Yamut, Lachish, Hebron, Dvir, all of the names of the cities in the region of Shevet Yehuda, which essentially is the description of the battle from Pasuk He down to Pasuk Yud Zayin, all the way from He to Tet Zayin. We saw when we read the parak the first time, is the focus of Yehuda and all the different campaigns of his Shevet, Yerushalayim, Lachish, Hebron, Devir, the story of Otniel ben Knaz, all of which, by the way, is a repeat from Sefer Yehoshua. It all appears in the story of the conquest of Shevet Yehuda in Sefer Yehoshua itself. And then we get to Pasuk Yud Zayin. Vayelech Yehuda et Shimon achiv. In response to the deal that they made, appropriately so, Shimon accompanied Yehuda on his campaign. And now it's time to respond to the treaty. Vayelech Yehuda et Shimon achiv vayaku et haknani yoshev tzvat vayachlimu ota vayikrat shem ha'ir chorma. Yehuda goes with Shimon. They conquer the city of Tzvat. Again, I told you that's in the south. They destroy it. They call it chorma. Vayilkod Yehuda et Aza ve'et kvula ve'et Ashkelon ve'et kvula ve'et Ekron ve'et kvula. And they begin to take the cities along the coast, Ekron, Eglon, Gezer, Ashdod, Ashkelon, which will be cities which essentially will belong, in theory, to Shevet Shimon, which is in the south. V'yashemet Yehuda v'yoresh et ahar. God was with Yehuda. They were able to conquer they were able to settle in the mountains. But kilo lahavishet yoshveh ha'emek kirecha v'azel lahem that even though they may have conquered the cities, they were never able to settle in the region of the plain. So we have a half a reference at the beginning of the parak and a half a reference at the end of the story to a relationship between Shevet Yehuda and Shevet Shimon, which is a clue that there's something going on between Yehuda and Shimon that requires further investigation. We have no other example of a partnership of this kind amongst the Shvatim, at least in this parak, and certainly we can go back to Yehoshua, but we don't find it there either. So this notion of I'll fight with you, you fight with me, is unique to the relationship between Yehuda and Shimon. And the question that we have to ask is it simply the fact that they got together and did something very nice and very praiseworthy, none of the other tribes were able to manage such a unified front? Or was it something specific to the relationship between Yehuda and Shimon that requires further investigation?
Why couldn't it just be territorial? I mean, they're both in the same general area.
Well, that's the question. Are they in the same general area, and should they be in the same general area? Comes back to the same question. So let's go back to Yehoshua. Go back to Sefer Yehoshua. A couple of sources that we're going to look at to kind of figure out what's going on. We're going to jump around a little bit today. If you don't have a Tanakh, then take a Tanakh, because we're going to jump around. We're not going to get back to Shoftim itself today. All right. If you recall, Sefer Yehoshua divides into two parts. We talked about this last year. Sefer Yehoshua divides into the first half, which is Yehoshua's conquest of Israel, a national campaign, in which he takes the entire army of Israel, fights in the south, fights in the north. And then Perek Yudbet summarizes his campaign in Canaan. And at that point, he sends each Shevet on their own to their tribal territory. There's a goral, where each Shevet belongs, and the responsibility is for each Shevet to go and conquer their own region or to settle in their region. So the second half of Yehoshua, from Perek Yud Gimel through till Perek Yud Zayin, or to Yud, through Yud Tet, is a list of each Shevet, where they went, what their territory was, and where they were supposed to conquer. If you look in Perek Yud Tet, and by the way, that sequence where Yehoshua gathers them all together, he throws the goralot and he says, okay, here's each tribe, you go and take your territory. They begin to list all the tribes and where they conquer. Who's listed first? Try to guess. Yehuda. Because Yehuda will always be first. That's the irony of it. Yehuda will always be first. So it goes through Yehuda, goes through the other tribes as well, Yosef, and then the smaller tribes, Benjamin, Perek Yud Tet.
Do you mean smaller because of the amount of territory, or smaller by number?
Both, yes. Both. The territory was divided essentially, give or take, by, according to the census, which would define the size. And the larger the tribe, the larger the territory they got. It's not completely accurate because some regions, it was also a function of financial, of economics. If some regions were more fertile, so you could achieve more in smaller amount of land, in smaller areas, so they divided it that way as well. But certainly, I think if you look at the map intuitively, the two largest tribes are Yehuda and Yosef. Yosef because he's a double tribe, and Yehuda because he was always the largest tribe. And if you look at the map geographically, you'll see that Yosef essentially is Ephraim and Manasseh together, which is the heart of the center of the country, and Yehuda is everything from Yerushalayim south. They certainly have the two largest territories. And the other tribes are relatively smaller than that, and therefore they have their territories are almost the same size to each other. Beginning of Perek Yutet. Vayetze ha-goral ha-sheni l'shim'on l'mateh b'nei Shimon l'mishpachotah. The second goral, the first one was for Yehuda. The first one was for Binyamin. The second goral is Shevet Shimon. Where does he get his territory? Vayhi nachalatam b'toch nachalat b'nei Yehuda. His nachala is inside the territorial region of Shevet Yehuda. Vayhi lahem b'nachalatam b'Sheva, Sheva u'molada. Their territory includes the city of Be'er Sheva and its regions. V'chatzar sh'al u'vala v'etzem ve'el tolad u'vetul v'chorma. Whole series of cities. Chorma is the one we just read about, Tzfat, which was called Chorma. V'tziklag u'betamar kavot v'chatzar susa. Another series of cities. Interesting, Tziklag is a very famous city, which here is given to Shevet Shimon, irony of ironies, because Tziklag is the hometown of, anybody remember? Where are you up to in Shmuel? Who's doing Shmuel? You're up to Shmuel Beth. Good. End of Shmuel Aleph. Very end of Shmuel Aleph is the destruction of the city of Tziklag by Amalek. Very famous. It's a famous story because it leads to a major battle. And Amalek moves up from the south into the city of Tziklag, captures all of the women and children. Hometown of Shevet Yehuda. But you're close.
David.
David's hometown is Tziklag. And that's why when David comes back from the war with the Plishtim, he discovers that while he was up from the north fighting with the Plishtim in the war with Shaul in Gilboa, the Amalek had come up to the city of Tziklag, captured all the women and children, and took it because David and all of the men were up fighting in the north, so they left. So the women and children were unprotected. Amalek came, took the women and children. David's wives, his family, everybody was taken. So David goes running after them, and in that battle, David essentially wipes out the remnant of Amalek. It's the story, famous battle of Tziklag. So the irony is that Tziklag will become the hometown of David HaMelech. And here, Tziklag is listed as the city, one of the cities of Shevet Yehuda, which is given to Shimon. Time permitting, at the end of the shiur, we'll talk about why that is the case. And then he goes on to list all the cities in total, Shlosh Esrei V'chatzrehen, a total number of 13 cities that Yehuda gives to Shimon, or that are given to Shimon within the territorial region of Shevet Yehuda. And again, in the end of this paragraph, Zot Nachalat Mateh B'nei Shimon L'mishpochotam, Mechevel B'nei Yehuda Nachalat B'nei Shimon. The territory of Shimon is a swath of land, is a chevel within the tribal territory of Yehuda. Ki haya chelet b'nei Yehuda rav mehem. Yehuda had much more territory than they needed. Vayinachalu b'nei Shimon b'toch nachalatam. And therefore Shimon was given a region within the tribal territory of Shimon. So it makes a lot of sense, of course, when you open up Sefer Shoftim and you read that Yehuda turns to Shimon and says, here, come with me and fight in my battles, assist me in the campaign, and I will assist you in your campaign. Translate, you fight for me in Shevet Yehuda, which will open up the region completely, and I will give you cities. Now, why do I need to give him cities? Why didn't Shimon have his own region? Binyamin has a region, Gad has a region, Reuven has a region. Every Shevet has a region. Why doesn't Shimon have his own region? Why do I need to put Shimon inside Shevet Yehuda?
What did Yaakov say to his kids or something? Isn't it
right? Right. So the story takes us back to the world of Shimon historically. And what happens to Shimon from the days of Yaakov all the way through till now, and even later in history as well. And that's what I wanted to do this morning, was to kind of explore the story of Shimon, the migration of Shimon. Where do they start and where do they end? But certainly at this point, we see them here as internally within Shevet Yehuda. Assuming that for reasons we haven't yet determined, we will in a moment, assuming that Shimon is given a region within Shevet Yehuda because, what would be the logical or ostensible reason for them not having their own tribal territory? Not having a status unto themselves?
Maybe stronger.
Why would I? Every other tribe gets their own land. Why would Shimon not get their own? What would be a logical reason for it?
Because of what Shimon and Levi did to the at the time of Dina.
Take it one step back, without the specifics. What would be a logical approach to the question of why Shimon doesn't have territory? I would assume it's because, without the specific example, I would assume it's because at some kind of punishment, their land was taken away from them. In other words, what I'm looking for now will have to be something along the lines of what Shimon may have done to, quote-unquote, lose a region unto themselves, and therefore be given specifically a tribal territory within the context of another shift. One of the logical places to look to would be the story of Dina, the story of Shechem, where Yaakov's anger at Shimon and Levi is kindled, and he responds to the events in Shechem with his brachos at the end of his life, in which he says specifically about Shimon and Levi that they will have a unique status amongst the tribes of Israel. We're going to start there. It's an insufficient place to end. In other words, it's a partial answer, because it's a little bit harsh to look at the historical role of Shimon on the basis purely or solely of the conduct of Shimon the ancestor many, many hundreds of years earlier. But it's certainly a start. So if we go back to Sefer Bereishit, go back to the end of Bereishit. Today we're going to do a little bit of jumping around. In distinction from other days, Yaakov's brachos to his children, which is in Parshat Vayechi, Perek Mem Tet. Vayikra Yaakov el Banav, Yaakov calls his children over. Vayomer, he says to them, He'asfu v'agid alechem et asher yikra etchem b'acharit hayamim. Come and I will tell you that which will befall you b'acharit hayamim. How do they translate b'acharit hayamim?
Last days.
In the?
Last days.
I think I would say almost every translation of Acharit Hayamim says something along the lines of last days, ending of days, after days. Well, after days actually is a better translation. After days is a better translation. Who says after days?
We just said that.
Oh, yeah, that's actually a much better translation. I'll buy yours.
It's a literal translation. Right. We're just translating.
I will buy your translation over all the others. And I'll tell you why. Immediately, when you think of Acharit Hayamim as ending of days or last days, what image conjures up in your mind?
Mashiach.
And the phrase appears throughout Tanakh. The Nevi'im use it extensively throughout Tanakh. V'ayah b'Acharit Hayamim nechon yehar bet Hashem, the Nevuah of Yishayahu it's called the Nevuah of Yishayahu of Acharit Hayamim, which is the whole Nevuah of the role of the Beit HaMikdash and the role of Mashiach. It has a messianic tone to it, and it certainly sounds like it's talking about what will be Bimot HaMashiach, when Jewish history will reach its climax or come to its goal or fruition. The problem, of course, in the context here is that Yaakov's brachos are confusing, unclear, ambiguous, and enigmatic, but one thing they are not is Messianic. There's nothing here about Yemot HaMashiach, which led Chazal to the famous comment, which Rashi quotes, Bikesh Yaakov legalot at haketz. Yaakov wanted to reveal to the people, to his children, what will be Yemot HaMashiach, the ketz. V'nistama mimenu, and it eluded him. For some reason, he had that moment where he wanted to reveal it, and it eluded him. To which he then said, "Oh, maybe it's because one of the faults of my children." So he said, "Is there one of you who is in doubt about your faith?" And of course, that led to the famous declaration of the children: "Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad." We are all unified in our faith in God. And Yaakov's response: "Baruch Hashem Kavod Machutol Yelam Be." There's another possibility, and the other possibility is that the word "Acharit Hayamim" may not mean end of days. Have we talked about this before? What would be the opposite of Acharit Hayamim? No, the opposite. Don't change the letters around, just the opposite, right? Lifnei. Of some kind, conjugated in some form, right? What is the biblical phrase used to describe events of the past?
Mekedem
is one way of looking at of one phrase, which is kind of like the ancient.
Right.
Sort of. But there's another phrase that's used in a number of places in Tanakh. Excuse me? Close. We say we there's a pasuk in Megillat Rut. We're most familiar with it from Megillat Rut, when Boaz meets the Ploni Almoni in the marketplace, and they have a whole discussion about Rut and about the mitzvah of Yibum, and then the Yibum and Chalitza, and then the Navi describes the process about how Chalitza took place. The Haya Lifanim beYisrael. What does Lifanim b'Yisrael mean? This was the conduct in the past. This is how things used to be. Lifanim b'Yisrael, Shalof ish na'alo, you would take your shoe off, etc. So Lifanim b'Yisrael means past. If Lifanim, which means that which is before you, is your past, then it stands to reason that Achor, or Acharit, is that which is
that which will come.
The future. Because they're opposite phrases. Now, you know, it's counterintuitive, because in English, we do it backwards. In English, your past is behind you, and your future is in front of you. But in Hebrew, and in biblical Hebrew, we understand intuitively that we walk through history backwards. Why do we walk through history backwards?
To learn.
No, because we see.
Because you can't see behind you.
You see the.
What's
past.
Hindsight?
100%.
That be able to see that which has occurred, right,
behind you,
which in conceptually is the
what
future
is in front of you,
right? Your that which is behind you means that which you can't see. What you can't see is that which hasn't occurred yet. That which is in front of you is that which you can see, which is your past. So the idiom in Hebrew is the exact opposite of the idiom in English. We walk through, just think about it like this, we walk through time backwards, which is how we walk through time. The Navi can look to the future, because the Navi can glance over his shoulder.
So why are most translations as
because because Chazal translated Acharit Hayamim in a kind of messianic context midrashically, and therefore they looked at every... But again, even what are they basing themselves on? They're basing themselves... The pshat is, acharit hayamim means the future. Every nevuah talked about a time in the future. What time were they talking about? It could be any time in the future. It could be 100 years from now, it could be 500 years from now. It depends on how we lived our lives at that point. The nevuah is a nevuah about, let's say in the context of Yeshayahu, it's a nevuah about Mashiach and about the building of the Beit HaMikdash. When will that occur? Anytime. Could occur 100 years from now, could be 10 years from now, right? So Achrit Yamim doesn't mean end, it means future. The Nevi'im talked about a time in the future. I have no idea why we translate it end of times, the end of days. It doesn't make any sense. But in this context, if you translate Achrit Yamim as simply the future, then Yaakov's Nevuah makes much more sense. And I don't have to go to this notion of him having had a Nevuah that dissipated from him and he got confused and he didn't know what was going on. He's simply telling them about some event that will take place in the future. For Yaakov, this is not one of the great mysteries or one of the great challenges that Mefarshim have is trying to figure out what Yaakov is trying to do in these brachas. But the simplest explanation is that he's dividing up, it's his will. He's on his deathbed and he's writing his will. What do you write in a will? That's an ethical will. What's a legal will? You take your property and you divide it amongst your children. Right? What's the only property Yaakov has to divide? The land of Israel. So the brachos that he gives to his children is a division of the land of Israel according to his children, according to their tribes. And if you look at the brachos in that perspective, you see that the focus is on which shevet will get which land. Simple. With a whole bunch of other issues related to it, but that's the primary focus. Which Shevet will get which territory? Because that's his will. And therefore, and he says, Hikavtzu v'shimu b'nei Yaakov v'shimu Yisrael avichem, listen to what I have to say to you. So he starts with Reuven. Reuven, b'chori ata, you are my b'chor. Therefore, what should be the status of a b'chor? He should get a double portion, because that's what a b'chor gets. But in this case, he's not going to get the double portion. The double portion will go to? No. No, right. The double portion will go to Yosef. The double portion will go to Yosef because he will get two tribal territories, Ephraim and Manasseh, equal to the rest of them. That's what he said in the previous parak. That double portion is reserved for Yosef. It either went to the Bechor of Rachel or to the Bechor of Leah. Leah's Bechor was Reuven. But Reuven, b'choriyata, kochiv reshitoni, yeteset v'yeteoz, as you are the firstborn, it should belong to you. But pachas kamayim al totar ki alita mishkavei avicha, as chilat yitzu yala. He refers somehow to the story either of Mechiret Yosef or to the story of Bilha. But in either case, he says, you're not getting the b'chor. So it'll go, not to Shimon, but to the b'chor of Rachel, which is Yosef. And therefore Yosef gets the double portion of Ephraim and Menashe. Next, Shimon and Levi. Shimon v'Levi achim. Klei chamas b'chorateh. Shimon and Levi, brothers in arms, as they say. Brothers in anger. V'sodam al tavo nafshi, b'kalam al tichat kvodi. When they get together in their council and in their gatherings, I don't want to have anything to do. Their anger, they killed people, and in their desire, they uprooted the ox. The enigmity of these words we're going to leave for now. Arur apam ki az ve'evratam ki kashata. He curses their anger, and then he says, Achalkem b'Yaakov v'afitzem b'Yisrael. I will divide them and scatter them. What do you mean I will divide them and scatter them? Again, if we bear in mind that this is a division of land according to the Shvatim, what is he saying about Shimon and Levi? Bikalam al tichad kvodi. Put them together, they're dangerous. Solution?
Separate them.
Divide them up. Scatter them. Achalkem b'Yaakov afitzem b'Yisrael. I will divide them and scatter them. Which double language, which is typical of Tanakh. In this case, it also has a significant ring for Shimon and Levi. Shimon is going to be divided, right? Handful of cities. We don't yet know where, but a handful of cities. It's going to be divided, scattered. And Levi will be afitzem, will be the difference between lechalek and lehafitz. Lechalek means to divide. And lehafitz?
Scatter.
Levi is in one area. Shimon is in one area. Just a handful of cities divided up. Levi, on the other hand, they're also cursed, but Levi redeems themselves many years later in the story of Chet HaEgel. So Levi is given a Nachla. Their Nachla is, Yaakov didn't give them land in the land of Israel, but they have a Nachla. Their Nachla will be the Beit HaMikdash. Hashem hu Nachalatam. Their Nachla will be the Mikdash. As far as where they will live, every tribe in Israel will give them cities. We talked about that in Sefer Yeshua. They'll be scattered, but they were scattered. So Yaakov's words came true. Just in Levi's case, they were transformed into a positive. Shimon's words will be transformed into a even further negative as the story unfolds. So Yaakov essentially sets the challenge. What happens to that bracha depends on their actions later on. From there, the brachas continue with the rest of the tribes, and you can see, I'm not going to go through it in detail, but you can see immediately that there's a geographic focus of all of the brachos. Yisachar, Chamor Garim, Movetz Minim Mishpatayim. Yisachar will dwell between the sheepfolds. I told you, Yisachar is sitting here in Emek Yisrael, in the valley between the mountain ranges. Zvulun L'chof Yamim Yishkon. Zvulun will dwell along the coast. He goes through each one, where they will live and where they how they will function. That's where the story begins. Shimon is going to be divided. What happens to Shimon, however, is that by and of itself is not completely sufficient. We need further analysis, because really there's two questions that we can ask. Number one, if you take their tribal territory away, then you have to ask yourself, where was their tribal territory supposed to be? What was their region originally supposed to be that it was taken away from them? Second of all, Yaakov doesn't say anything about taking their land away from them. All he says is that they'll be divided. So they'll be divided. They won't be in one locale. They'll be scattered away a little bit, divided up. But he doesn't say, I'm going to take their land away from them. That doesn't happen until Moshe. Moshe divides the land of Israel, which he will do again. Moshe will take the land away from them. How do I know? Turn to the second set of brachot that divide up the land of Israel, namely, where do I find a second set of brachot that divide the land? I've given you two clues. Brachot and Moshe.
Does that have bracha?
Thank you very much. Excellent. Got to pick up the clues here. You know. In Peshat Vezot HaBracha. Perek.
Can I say one thing? Yeah. You're talking about when Yosef was, Yaakov was giving the brachas to his sons. One of the portions says that none of those brachas, quote unquote, were really curses, because of the fact that if Chas V'Shalom, he would have given Reuven leadership and all that, you know, opposed to Yehuda, he was so impulsive that it would have been a disaster to be a leader and be so impulsive. So in reality, it wasn't a curse per se, but it was to discipline them in a certain way that would be conducive to constructive rather than counterproductive.
I